we have an inside joke about how fish chowder or seafood chowder is just ocean bug soup.
It is all ocean bug soup, exactly.
Yeah.
If shrimp are bugs, does that make seafood chowder warm, milky bug soup? I have the answer to this burning question right here on this episode of What Do Scientists Do?, a podcast for curious kids and inquisitive adults. Each episode, I interview a different, wicked smart guest and learn about what they do and why they do it. Today, I got to nerd out about entomology with Aaron Fairweather, a postdoc fellow at the University of Guelph. They have a master's in integrative biology and a PhD in environmental science. That's a whole lot of school. Aaron focuses on entomology, myrmecology, genetics, and ecotoxicology. In simple words, that means that they study insects, ants, their DNA, and how pollutants in the environment impact insects. I had a blast learning about one of the most diverse creatures, and I hope you do too. Keep on listening. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to What Do Scientists Do? Every episode, I interview a wicked smart guest and learn all about their favorite science topics. Today, we're going to be learning about my favorite types of creepy crawlies, and these are bugs, insects, critters like that. What's the difference between a bug and an insect? I don't know. Hopefully, we're going to find out today. So here's our very special guest. Can you introduce yourself with your name and pronouns?
My name is Dr. Aaron Fairweather. I use they, them pronouns.
And what kind of scientist are you?
I'm an entomologist, so somebody that studies insects, and more specifically, I focus on ants, which is a myrmecologist.
So when you introduce yourself to somebody new, would you call yourself a myrmecologist?
I typically start with entomologist because I like bugs in general. Like, I just love anything creepy crawly as well, but I specialize in ants, so I will specify if people want to know a little bit more.
So what got you into bugs and ants specifically?
So it's a lifelong story. I had just always been interested in insects ever since I was a really little kid. I was the weird kid on the playground, like looking at the anthills while everybody else played soccer. And I kept little journals and stuff as young as 3 years old, drawing little caterpillars I'd find, raising them into butterflies and that kind of thing. I just kept on going with it. There was always more to learn. And I love that about insects. So I just kept going and going and going.
Fantastic. And now you're a doctor of bugs.
Yep. Doctor of bugs.
So I kind of opened with this, but maybe you can clarify here. Is there a difference between a bug and an insect?
There is. So technically, bug refers to one specific group of insects, the true insects or the true bugs called Hemiptera. Everything else is just generally called an insect, but people generally use bug as a term for anything that crawls on the legs and on, you know, the ground and freaks them out a little bit.
So insects have a specific number of legs. And if you were to define what an insect is, what would that be?
The strict definition of an insect is a arthropod, so an exoskeletal organism that has three segments, a head, thorax, and abdomen, and then six legs. That is an insect.
And then what makes an ant an ant?
So ants are part of a specific group of insects called the Hymenoptera, or the bees, wasps, and ants. And they have a very specific kind of body form. So there are one of the key defining characteristics is that little cinched waist that a lot of these groups have. It's called the wasp waist, but ants have it as well. And then there's some features like their antenna and their eyes that are unique to that group. And then also their behavior and that kind of thing. Ants specifically are one of the eusocial groups. So it's a very small subset of the Hymenoptera that make up the eusocial wasps and bees and then ants.
What does eusocial mean?
So it's an interesting term. There is a bunch of elements that go into it. The gist of it is that you have a group of organisms that are cooperating towards the goal of survival of the group, and specifically the reproductive survival of the group. So you have cooperative brood care, i.e. looking after babies together, You have overlapping generations, so they're all working together with their kids and adults and all that kind of thing. And they're part of this bigger hive, and they all kind of work together in a specific way.
So is there like ant daycare?
There is. So ants are really interesting because they have something called castes. Castes are different jobs within the nest. And sometimes these castes can actually have different body forms, even though they're genetically identical almost to one another. They can look different. And sometimes they're just behavioral differences. So they do different things in the nests. And one of these castes is a nurse. So they specifically look after the brood and the babies and the nests and make sure that they're raising them properly. One of the things I find really fascinating about that too is sometimes these castes can change over the course of the life of the ant. So they can start off as a really energetic young scout looking for food and that kind of thing. And then they can slowly, as they get older, transition into nurses because they don't have as much energy anymore. They can't actively search out in the environment. So they stay at the nests and work in these daycares.
That's really cute. I've never thought of ants as having that kind of difference in their life. I always think of ants as like either workers or drones. I don't know if that's bee specific language, but I've always thought of them as having kind of one role to do, but that actually changes throughout their life.
Yeah. And there's some really interesting depth to that. Sometimes it's not even their stage of life, but it can be if they've faced hardship even. So there's a species of ant in Africa called Colobopsis solepsis, and it specifically has a lot of conflict with local ant groups. So different species, but even sometimes within the same species, different colonies can go to war with one another. And after these big ant wars, some ants come home and they are missing limbs or they're damaged or what have you. And some of these damaged workers will then become nurses because, again, they're not fit enough to be out in the general environment anymore.
That's so cool. Ants kind of adapt and change. So that's kind of the background on what ants are. And what kind of questions do you specifically ask about ants?
So right now I'm looking at how can we use ants to assess ecosystem health. So especially in agricultural ecosystems, it's really important that we have functioning soil, that it has high nutrient content, that there is a variety of species that are contributing different services to the plants and the nutrients and the water cycle and everything that is functioning properly, so we can get the maximum amount of food that we need to survive as people. And so I use ants to make sure that we don't apply too much chemicals in the environment and we're damaging them, not if we don't apply too much fertilizer or if the soils are healthy enough to sustain a functioning ecosystem way. So I'm asking those kinds of questions. And then I'm also just interested in what ants are where and what are they doing. I think that is at my core, like my most fascination is finding new things, finding new species, naming them, and then documenting where they are, what they're doing, and what makes them unique.
Have you been around for like a new ant discovery?
So I haven't found a new ant per se. I found some rare species of ants and new species to Canada. So like new documentations where we've known them from other places in the world before. I have named a couple of beetle species though, through some of my field work.
Can you share their names?
Yeah. So one of them is, Cynomys maritimus, so from the maritime provinces. One of them, yeah, exactly. I love my roots. One of them is Cynomys, forget how to pronounce it actually, it's a long name. I think it's Monostorus. It's specifically referencing what kind of mushroom it's found on. And then there's two other species that I don't actually remember the names of that I helped name. I didn't actually name myself.
That makes me feel better because, you know, even scientists that are naming these things have a hard time pronouncing the big Latin names. I have a background in mycology and fungi. So maybe this is a selfish little question here, but can you tell me a little bit about that ant fungi situation?
Yeah. So there's a group of beetles called the rove beetles, and they occupy a huge range of ecological niches, but there's quite a few genera of them that specialize on mushrooms. So they'll be found in the gills of mushrooms and feed on things like the spores in the mushrooms themselves sometimes. And during some of the biological research surveys that I've been a part of, we've specifically been asking the question of like, what is the diversity of these beetles and these mushrooms? And you can imagine with a lot of these beetle species, like not many people are looking for them, let alone we don't know where they are, what they're doing. So part of that research was just documenting that kind of thing, finding new things and naming them. And it's actually pretty easy to do. You can probably go out in your backyard, and if you put enough time in, find something that's new to science, just because there's so many insects out there. We just don't have enough people working on them.
So what does that process look like as a scientist? Do you just go out in your own backyard with a magnifying glass and go, ooh, that's a new beetle?
Sometimes, yeah. There's actually one of the researchers I worked with, Reggie Webster, who's the specialist on this group of beetles. He has, I think, about 15 papers now documenting the beetles in his backyard. And he just goes out every weekend over the summer and tries to find new things in his own backyard, and often does find really new things. It's really, really interesting.
One of my favorite things about science that we've talked about, or I've talked about on the podcast, is discovering new things and how one of the most fun parts of science is creating new knowledge and discovering something. And also the role that creativity has in that kind of process. Do you find yourself doing a lot of creative work in your day-to-day as a scientist?
Absolutely, all the time. One of the things that's really fascinating from the lab side of things, if you do laboratory experiments, is you have to create new techniques or new means of testing things. So that can mean building a new nesting container that's specialized for a specific species, or finding a way to apply, in my case, like pesticides or nutrients, fertilizers to these ants in a way that represents how they would be exposed in the broader environment. And that can just be about MacGyvering your way around the lab equipment, putting things together that nobody's put together before. Nobody's making this equipment for us, so often we have to make it ourselves. And one of the things that I did was I took a bunch of soup containers that I bought off Amazon, and cut them down to make this kind of thin, almost, if you imagine what the old ant farms look like, how they're two pieces of glass very thinly together. I did that in a cone shape with these soup containers, and it was just happened to be the best way to see the tunnels that the ants were making, and then see where the pesticides would go when I applied them over the surface, and if they went through the tunnels or went elsewhere in the soil, how the ants were being impacted by them. I could see all that visually. So being able to do that and put those together required a lot of time, and some of my lab assistants helped me come up with designs and that kind of thing, and we did it together.
Cool. So that sounds like a very creative and engineering process. So when you're observing them bringing the pesticides down, is that something that you can visually see, or do you have to do a chemical analysis? What's that scientific process like?
So it's a combination of things. It depends on how you're applying it. Pesticides sometimes are applied via seed treatments, and we can actually see the ants go to the surface, grab the seeds, and bring them back into their nest sometimes. So that's one way we're actively seeing them kind of come in contact and be exposed to them. Another common way to apply them is through soil drenches. So you put it in water or oil and then apply it over the surface of the ground, and then it seeps into the ground. And as that process happens, we can see where that water goes in the tunnels of the ant colonies and see the ants kind of get soaked in it. And that's a very surface level exposure to these kinds of pesticides. And then testing how that impacts them, some of it is visual. So seeing, once they've absorbed this pesticide, if it changes their behavior, are they starting to forage less? A lot of these pesticides are neurotoxins. So do they start to shake and have tremors and exhibit those kinds of symptoms? Sometimes it's subtle things. So are they able to groom each other efficiently? Are they doing the same way of grooming, that they used to? That kind of thing. And then in terms of the end of the experiment, if we see some of the ants die, or if we're just generally interested to see how much they were being exposed to, we can sample the soil and put that through what's called a mass spectrometer to see what kind of compounds are present. We can also take the dead ants and grind them up and put them through the same thing and see how much of that pesticide got inside their bodies.
I love all of the different kind of pieces of science that come together. We've got the mass spectroscopy.
Yeah.
And then we've got all these kind of different assays and stuff to help support a hypothesis or, you know, rebuttal a hypothesis. So what kind of stuff have you found? Have you found any like answers yet about how pesticides affect ants?
Yeah. So I just published my thesis a few months ago. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And we found some pretty substantial evidence that through contact exposure, through these soil drenches, that some of the commonly used insecticides might be applied in way too high of a concentration. So some of these ants were dying at as low as 25% the field application rate of these compounds. And a lot of that, you kind of say like, oh, well, how do we know that some of these beneficial insects are being impacted in this way? It's because sometimes we don't have the proper institutions in place to say we have to test these things. We have to test these species specifically because they might be impacted. Nobody's looked at it before. And so I was one of the first ones to do this through contact soil-mediated toxicity. And yeah, there was some significant detrimental impacts to these ant species. It would impact them establishing nests, and a lot of the workers were impacted more than even the queens. So a lot of the ants that would be foraging along the surface of the soil would be exposed more and would die a lot quicker, that kind of thing.
Spooky stuff. You mentioned beneficial insects. Do you kind of want to explain what that means?
So it's kind of funny from my perspective, because I view all insects as beneficial in some way. You know, because I love all insects in general, I think there's always a reason to have each species around on the planet. But from a perspective of a very specific stakeholder, say a farmer that is interested in maximizing the amount of food that you make on your land, there are some species that are going to help that happen and some species that will detrimentally impact that. So they will like eat the crops or damage crops growth. And that is pest species. Beneficial insects are things like the bees that pollinate the crops and help the plants grow. There are things like the ants that can be predators sometimes or are cycling nutrients and aerating the soil, helping the plants grow. Things like spiders and beetles, they're also predators and can help regulate pest species and that kind of thing. So those are the two groups that we sometimes deal with in agricultural entomology.
I can't wait to tell my partner tonight that spiders are actually really good. You mentioned that your like passion is in where bugs are or where insects are and like insect or ant diversity and stuff. And I noticed that you did your master's thesis all about how humans are impacting the different types of ants in an area. Do you want to just like, what did you find?
Yeah, so I was looking at ants in old growth forests compared to recently clear cut sites for forestry and seeing if the communities shifted and if the species themselves were changing and adapting to those kinds of environments. And I found that ants actually preferred the clear cut sites. There was a higher diversity typically in these clear cut forests. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that these forests ended up becoming warmer, the soils were exposed more, which meant there was more surface area for the ants to nest in. A lot of the dead wood debris that was left on these clear-cut sites would then be used by the ants to start to nest in them. And the interesting thing about that, too, is some of that speaks to the fact that these organisms then are able to move into these ecosystems and start to repair it in a way. The ants are nesting in these logs and breaking them down and moving those nutrients in the soils, aerating things, allowing more spaces for trees to get their seeds into and to actually start growing. And then as these forests become older and start to change, the community composition starts to change as well. You start to see some of these ants that are really highly adapted to these warm, drier environments of a clear-cut forest start to become species that are preferential to things like mosses, things that need a more damp, colder environment to grow. Some of these species will specialize in those environments. And then some species still, if you see them present, it can mean really good things for the regeneration of that forest. There's one species in particular in Canada called Aphenogaster picea, and it's recently kind of been titled a keystone species in forests because they contribute to the growth and the health of the ecosystem in a very significant degree. With this ant present, the forest can grow up to 2 times faster compared to with them absent because they are specifically going out seeking the seeds and bringing them into their nests and not eating them, but letting them grow and to grow up the forest, kind of gardeners of the forest. It's really, really cool.
That's really cool. It makes me think of the ants that collect the fungi. I can't remember the name. Are those, what are those?
There's a whole bunch of ants that do it.
Okay.
The most commonly known one is the leafcutter ants.
Yes, the leafcutter ants. So are they bringing the seeds back to garden on purpose?
Yeah. So it's kind of twofold. They've evolved in tangent with these trees. So this co-evolution to know that eventually the trees will grow up and they will provide more like shelter, but also they'll start producing more seeds, which means it's more food for them. Some even understory herbs, things like you'll get ferns and trilliums and a variety of other things. Their seeds have actually co-evolved so tightly with ants that they have this growth on them. It's, I forget the name of it actually. I'm blanking on the name. But it's this growth of almost like a fruit that is specifically for the ants. It's almost like an ant gift. And they take it, when they take it into their nest, it will be released and the ants get that as a food resource. Then the herbs grow up and the ants, again, they're kind of reinforced that if they grow up this herb, they get more and more and more of that resource. I think it's called an Elysium or a Lyceum, something like that. Yeah.
So it's like a win-win for both the plants and the ants.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Gnarly. Wicked. So I guess we've kind of been talking all about your favorite ant facts, but do you have like a single ant, favorite ant fact that you can just like put your finger right on? Like, what is your favorite ant fact, I guess, is the question.
Oh, it's, again, it's so hard to choose because there's so many cool species. I think one of my favorite local species is called Stigmatoma palipes, and it's known commonly as the Dracula ant. It's a really cool name. And they almost look very menacing. They have these really long mandibles that are sickle-like. And they are pretty ferocious predators, but part of the other adaptive feature of these long mandibles is that they use them to drink the blood of their babies. Really weird adaptation. Instead of feeding on the things that they capture when they're foraging, they bring it back to the nest, feed it to their offspring, the larva, and then the larva almost process it. They are getting it digested for their own bodies, but then because it's so much more nutrient rich in the way that the larvae process it, they tick a little hole in the side of the larvae where the hemolymph starts to come out, their blood, and they'll start drinking that as a nutrient resource, and then they'll seal it back up with some spit. And we still don't know why they do it. Like, it seems like it would be dangerous to have it happen to that degree to your offspring, but they do it.
It makes me think of birds feeding their babies, but just kind of cycling back and then the birds feeding. That's so bizarre. That's so cool. Yeah. That is a great ant fact. If you had Dr. Fairweather's billboard and you could put it across the planet everywhere and it could say like one thing, what would you want your billboard to say?
So I was thinking about this question a lot. I think like I have my silly, catchy answer and then kind of my more, you know, professorial doctorate kind of answer. And I think my silly answer is, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a meme that's been going around a lot lately. And it's just this statement. Somebody had it stitched on a hat, but it just says shrimp is bugs. And it's so silly. I love it. And like, I just want a billboard that just has that in big letters and then a shrimp behind it and then a link to a website. And for me, it speaks to some, I mean, it's a fun meme, but it also speaks to a truth about the fact that, you know, shrimp and insects are super closely related. They're technically in the same, you know, overall group and are bugs in essence. And people have this kind of really strong positive association with shrimp. I mean, they're like an amazing food resource. They're also kind of cute. People don't seem to be afraid of them, but a lot of insects people are afraid of, and people don't kind of understand the fact that these shrimp can be, or these insects can be, a food resource as well. They often are in a global context. And so part of that kind of statement for me is just sharing that there isn't a difference, that like the only difference that exists is the perception of what we grow up with and what we think about these things from, you know, how we were taught about them. And that's changing. Like, as people are getting more educated and understanding these things, we already see that with groups like the bees. I would say 60 years ago, bees didn't have as good of a reputation as they do now. It used to be, you know, always avoid the bees. They're going to sting you. Be careful around them. But now, anytime you see bees, because of the whole pollinator crisis, there are these cute, you know, animations of bees that are around. There's these cute like bee faces, and they're seen as fluffy and kind and very like important pollinators and beneficial insects. Nobody is afraid of bees anymore. And I think that can happen with all insects.
We need to get the bees PR team on ants is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a little bit that's happening because we've gotten things like YouTube has been a huge blessing for the ant community, I think.
I need to ask you about Ants Canada.
Oh, yes. I talk about this, I feel like, on any kind of interview I'm in, because I love it from a science perspective, but also just like from a science communication and interest perspective. Like, there's this guy that just loved ants so much and didn't want to necessarily study them or anything, but just loved keeping them and thought they were really cool. And there was that whole boom in the 90s of like the ant farms and everything. And he took that to the next level and now has this multi-million subscriber channel talking about ants, and people just love it. And I think that those kind of little changes, when you get to know insects and all organisms on a very personal level, they change from something that can be scary or intimidating to something fascinating and interesting. And they can still be potentially dangerous. Like, you don't want to touch a bullet ant or something like that, but you can appreciate it from afar and know how cool it is to have it around. But Ants Canada specifically is an interesting story because Mikey, who runs the channel, is originally from Ontario, Canada, and that's why it's called Ants Canada, though he lives in the Philippines now. And I followed the channel when it was like 15 subscribers, and I had just moved to Ontario learning ants, and we connected a little bit, messaged back and forth way back when. And then, you know, we kind of fell out of contact, and I was doing my schooling, and, you know, he was blowing up this channel. And then I come back like 3 years later, and it's at a million subscribers. And I'm like, whoa, people love ants.
The colony has grown.
Yeah.
I love Ants Canada. It's so fun to put on in the background and just watch ants do what they're so good at doing.
Yeah.
So we're kind of wrapping up here, but do you want to share with me like your favorite science or industry activity or thing that you've ever done? Is there anything that like stands out to you?
I've been very blessed with having a really adventurous run of it with entomology and getting to see and do a lot of really cool things. I think one of my favorite adventures was going to Costa Rica and sampling in the cloud rainforest, finding ants there. And then we did a sampling of the whole elevation of this mountain. And it starts in the dry, arid forest on the base of the mountain and goes up and gets more and more cloud forest. And just seeing that difference in ecosystem and all of the organisms, you go from like in one, say, 100 meter area, you have a completely different set of diversity from the next 100 meter area up on the mountain. It's incredible.
That's bananas. Did you, unrelated to ants, did you see any sloths?
I saw some sloths, but it was at a sloth sanctuary. I didn't get to see them in the wild.
Still counts. All right. So do you want to close us off with like one final ant fact? You seem like you have so many, and I'd love to learn one final ant fact as well.
Okay. Something that links to my, you know, pesticide research and also ants in a really interesting way. There is a species of ant called the lemon ant from Costa Rica, and it produces a herbicide in its body and will actually cull as big an area as like a football field around its nest to make sure only the plants that it wants around it will grow. So it really, these ants have evolved to the level of, you know, being large scale farmers and agricultural like ecosystem engineers in the same way that we are. And they've been using pesticides a lot longer than we have to do the same thing. Really cool.
Thank you so much. I think that's a beautiful ant fact to end the episode with. And, you know, protecting ants and protecting pollinators and all the little ecosystem services that the creepy crawlies provide, you know, might make you think twice before you smush a spider or get your partner to do it for you.
Absolutely. That is my hope.
A humongous thank you to Aaron Fairweather for their time, energy, and ant facts. I have been so annoying about ants lately, to the chagrin of everybody in my life. And also a huge thank you to everybody listening. For more science fun, you can find us on Twitter or Instagram at supernova@dal. Do you have a question you'd like answered? You can send us an email or a voice recording at whatdoscientistsdo@superstaff.ca, and we might just answer your question on the show. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next episode. Bye-bye for now. This show was made by Supernova at Dalhousie University, a network member of Actua. For more information on our summer camps, workshops, and more, visit supernova.dal.ca.